May it please the court, Craig Weinberg, registration number 19030, on behalf of the defendant appellant Elizabeth Cook. Your honors, there are at least four questions in the briefs that remain unanswered by Neuflower, and I'd like to address those or lay those out for you and then proceed. The first issue not addressed is a pivotal issue in the case, and that is whether Neuflower can avoid paying contractual interest as opposed to statutory or any other form of interest by simply depositing the money that it owed to Ms. Cook into the court. The second issue not addressed is why any of the $4.85 million that was paid on January 2, 2008 needed to be placed in escrow. Rather, it was only the $1.9 million that was due on funding of the venture capital transaction that was to be escrowed. The third issue, not addressed by either the trial court or by Neuflower, is whose duty it was to break up the Family Limited Partnership note, or what we've called the FLP note. And as I've laid out in the briefing, in the amended separation agreement, that duty fell squarely upon Neuflower, not Ms. Cook. And the final issue, really not addressed, is what more could my client have done in this case in order to attain the benefit of her bargain? She signed off on certain agreements and expected compliance with those agreements. She secured an account, a brokerage account, to receive the $1.9 million. And yet the result of the trial court's ruling is that my client did not get the $1.9 million, did not get the use of that money during the period of time that was contemplated by the agreements, and she did nothing wrong. So what happened is Neuflower brought the interpleader action, or what they've characterized as an interpleader action. My client filed a counterclaim on a promissory note. She was still holding the promissory note, the $4.85 million note that was made to her personally. It's not disputed, as I indicated, that Ms. Cook received $4.85 million on January 2nd, but you have to still look to see whether any amounts were owed on that note to determine the viability of that claim. What Cook did was she treated the $4.85 million payment as satisfying the obligation, or her share of the obligation, under the FLP note. The settlement agreement from October of 2007 explicitly gave her that right. It gave her the discretion to make that allocation. She made that allocation, which resulted in leaving a balance due on her individual note of approximately $1.9 million. The trial court's ruling, which granted a summary judgment, so this court's going to look at it de novo anyway, but the trial court's ruling had the impact of deleting that very provision of the settlement agreement because it took away her right to make the allocation. Neuflower has argued,
Mr. Weinberg, the trial court didn't say that it was ignoring that provision, did it? I think the trial court said that it couldn't be read in an isolated fashion separately from the terms of the accompanying or earlier separation agreement, amended separation agreement.
That is correct. That's what the trial court said, but the impact of what the trial court did was to ignore it or delete that provision from the contract because it did not allow or did not recognize at the end of the day Cook's right to allocate, because had it done so, it would have found there was a remaining balance due on the individual note and analyzed the claim differently. The trial court and Neuflower's position, as you indicated, was that you couldn't look at it in isolation because you had to look at it in conjunction with the fact that the FLP note needed to be broken up into smaller notes for each of the limited partners. The problem with that analysis, and as I alluded to in the opening remark, was that the trial court and Neuflower haven't considered whose duty it was to do that. It was not Ms. Cook's duty to break up the FLP note. She is the holder of the note. It's the maker's obligation. It was explicitly spelled out in the amended separation agreement that Neuflower shall execute new notes. So again, if we're looking in the scheme of who's at fault here, My client didn't do anything but honor the agreements. New Flower takes its failure to break up the FLP note and uses that as an excuse for why the transaction isn't consummated. And as I've argued to the trial court and to this court, the prevention doctrine precludes New Flower from doing that. One can't cause the failure of a condition to one's own performance. There was really nothing for New Flower to have done. There were no negotiations to have been done. All of this was spelled out in the amended separation agreement, which New Flower was also a signatory and a party to. The amended separation agreement said precisely what the form of that note was supposed to look like. It was supposed to look exactly like the larger FLP note, which was attached as an exhibit to the amended separation agreement. So all that needed to be done was for New Flower to write separate notes for each of the FLP partners in the amount specified in the form of the promissory note that was already in existence.
And that was supposed to be done upon the dissolution of FLP, is that correct?
It was supposed to be done in conjunction with the dissolution.
In conjunction with the winding up and the dissolution.
Well, in conjunction with the dissolution. It was contemplated in the October settlement agreement that, let me back up. The formal dissolution of the FLP had been done months earlier. There was a document, it's in the record, that was filed with the Secretary of State dissolving the Family Limited Partnership. Then came the task of how do we divide up this pool of assets amongst the various partners. And there were disputes amongst Mr. Gilliland and Ms. Cook about how that should proceed and what the tax ramifications were to be associated with that. And so they agreed, at least initially, to have a CPA, Alex Barris, undertake that task. It was contemplated explicitly by October of 2007 that that task was going to be done by November 15th of 2007, that the FLP's assets would be divided by that date. It's stated explicitly in the October agreement that that would occur. That did not, in fact, occur, although I don't know that those facts appear in the record. However, part and parcel of what needed to happen to divide those assets was division of the notes. The division of the other FLP assets, Your Honors, had absolutely nothing to do with the division of the notes because the notes had already been taken care of on how those were getting divided out, and that was laid out in the amended separation agreement. The second point that New Flower raises is really a difficult one from my perspective as far as how to interpret this or understand it. They are arguing that the allocation right has to be considered together with the requirement that the money be deposited in the escrow. And again, I alluded to this in one of the opening questions that hopefully the court will ask Ms. Bruch about. None of the $4.85 million that was due on January 2nd, 2008 was to be deposited in that escrow. Absolutely not one single nickel. That money was received by Ms. Cook outright. The money that was supposed to get placed into the escrow account was the $1.9 million principal due to Cook under the settlement agreement upon funding. And so what the parties really did here in the settlement agreement was they modified the maturity dates of these notes, and that's pretty much what it says in the settlement agreement. The notes remained in effect, but the maturity dates changed. The $4.85 million the payment was advanced about a year to January 2nd, 2008. It was due under the original note December 31, 2008. The $1.9 million, or the larger FLP note, had been due also December 31, 2008, but they advanced Cook's share of that to be received upon funding because that was why Ms. Cook signed off on this whole deal. The debts that she was owed by her ex-husband, who was gaining control of the company, were supposed to have been taken off by this venture capital deal.
Mr. Weinberg, if I could address an issue that you raised at the outset of your argument, the first issue that you said wasn't addressed, which is whether New Flower can avoid paying contractual interest. Having read the briefs, I don't have any idea of what the difference is between the interest that you say that you're seeking and the interest that was paid to on the $1.9 million after it was deposited in the court registry?
There's a big difference, Your Honor.
Can you tell us what that difference is? And secondly, whether that difference information is in the record?
That difference information might be in the record. I'm not sure if the actual dollar amount that she withdrew from the registry when the case was being finalized is in the record. But the difference is the interest accruing in the court registry, 1% or less. The promissory note was anywhere, I think, I think it was in the October agreement, 8% to 12% if we're looking at default rates. So whatever that differential is for the period of time that the money was tied up in court, or whatever else is owed under that note, the note remains effective. That's what the parties agreed to. I think it's a numerical calculation, but it's hundreds of thousands of dollars in interest.
Was that argued in the district court?
The legal principle, as far as, yes, you don't get to avoid paying contractual interest.
I'm not asking about the legal principle. I'm asking about the practical difference.
The dollar amount of the difference, I don't believe anybody quantified how much of a difference it made depositing the funds into the court registry. But let me be clear about the difference, what I'm talking about. In an interpleader case, the stakeholder throws the money into the court, doesn't care how the competing claimants figured out, I've washed my hands with it, I'm done. So these competing claimants then, as the case law says, get a judgment against the fund. And that's why there's no interest that accrues to the stakeholder. It washed its hands. That's not this case, Your Honor. This is somebody who threw money into court. There weren't competing claimants to the money. Nobody else made a claim to this money. My client holds a promissory note, a contract right, to receive interest until she is paid. The benefit of her bargain under the October agreement was the ability to use this money, invest this money until the conditions were satisfied, which in this case would have been the passage of time. And on January 2nd, 2009, that money was to have been released or free from the escrow. But while it remained in the escrow, she had the right to invest it however she wanted. Instead, it was deposited into an account to which she did not agree. She did not mutually consent to the trial court's registry. And again, I ask you, what did she do wrong? She didn't do anything wrong.
Okay, to go back to my question, though, does the record indicate that there was an 8% interest rate payable on the promissory note?
Yes, clearly. The October settlement agreement, Your Honor, in paragraph 1D, indicated that the promissory note says the interest rate is fixed to 8.25% and the maturity date is modified as set forth in the settlement agreement. That's paragraph 1D on page 3 of the settlement agreement. The promissory note itself, Your Honor, is also in the record as one of the exhibits for the summary judgment motion. And I'll reserve the rest of my time. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. You have 1 minute and 47 seconds left.
May it please the court. My name is Kim Bruch. I'm here on behalf of New Flower Market, Inc. To begin with respect to, I believe, the issue that was kind of left off related to the overall mechanism which New Flower utilized in this case is an interpleader action. And I think that provides the framework for this entire scenario. New Flower didn't deposit these funds with the court to avoid its payment obligation or to somehow deprive Ms. Cook of the funds. There was no dispute that the maturity date for the promissory note came up. The issue that precluded the payment, which is the mechanism that started this whole thing, was that there were other conditions related to these payments that had to be looked at before a payment could be made. It wasn't the promissory note in isolation of the other agreements that are at reference here.
Well, if I could interrupt you, Ms. Bruch, assuming that there were valid reasons for New Flower to file an interpleader action, nevertheless, why wouldn't Ms. Cook be entitled to interest on the promissory note after the money was deposited with the court registry?
Well, I think, first of all, the case law in Colorado is very clear that when you properly utilize the interpleader function under the Vento case, it does terminate the right of whoever's claiming rights to the fund. It insulates, which is the whole purpose of the interpleader statute, it insulates the person depositing the funds into the court. I think the entire purpose of the interpleader action is it provides a safe way for somebody who, like Newflower was, who's facing competing claims to funds, to say, I'm not going to be responsible for default interest and attorney's fees because I'm not making this payment. I'm going to put it in the court and say, Your Honor, we are making this payment. We don't dispute that that's happening. We want the court to determine the various competing claims and determine who gets the money. I think the other issue here is that there was no interest that wasn't contemplated under the note that wasn't paid. It was undisputed in the court that it was paid through the maturity date, and in fact there was some interest that was later deposited to catch that up and make sure that everything that was due under the note was paid. So there was no shortfall of interest that was expected to Ms. Cook. Everything that was contemplated through the date of maturity was paid. The only interest that is not being paid based on the interpleader is default interest based on non-payment of the note at the maturity date. And it would be, I think the claim that Ms. Cook made, although it's true there are no numbers in the record as far as I recall, was that she was seeking not the regular interest under the note because that was all paid. She's seeking default interest based on the fact that Newflower deposited the funds in the court instead of paying her.
If I can try and add some specificity to what you're saying, are you saying that interest was paid through January 2nd, 2008 or 2009?
Yes.
Is that information in the record?
I believe it is, and I think that the stipulation, when the parties finally stipulated to disbursement of the funds, I think it was specified in there that all interest was paid through that date. I believe that that is reflected in that stipulation.
So is the crux of the dispute here the amount of interest that should have been paid between January 2nd, 2009 and some date in April of 2009 when the money was released to Ms. Cook?
I think that's the crux of it. I believe that Ms. Cook's position also was that the default would have triggered prior to the maturity date. So I think there's also a period in time prior to that when they would suggest that they would be entitled to the default interest under the note as well as following the maturity date. Also, they want to trigger the provision under the note based on the interpleader for their attorney's fees and costs. It's all wrapped into one argument.
So, and when you say default interest, what was that interest rate? Was that different from the 8.25% that Mr. Weinberg described?
I believe it was higher, and that was the whole reason they were arguing default versus regular, but I'm not sure I know the correct percentage.
Okay, thank you.
Well, as Mr. Weinberg notes, Vento applies to the accrual of statutory interest rather than contractual interest after default or on an interpleader, on interpleader funds. What's your response to that? Why is there a difference, and if so, what is it?
Well, I would first suggest that there was no further contractual interest. Upon maturity, we deposited the funds into the court, and we would consider our obligation complete at that point. I think that's consistent.
Do you have authority for that?
No, I don't. There is no Colorado authority beyond Vento and the cases cited by Vento. However, that's consistent with the purpose of Rule 22, which is the interpleader, which the whole purpose of that court procedural mechanism is to insulate a party who's facing a situation just like Newflower. If we had paid the money without depositing in the court, we would have faced potential claims from all three of those parties that we named in the lawsuit. The only way to avoid that, and fortunately there is a procedural function in Colorado that protects a party in a position like Newflower, is to deposit it with the court and allow each of those parties then to either come in and make a claim or not make a claim, but to allow the court to determine the various legal positions of the party. I think it only is an extension of that rule and the purpose of that rule to say that, as well as not getting statutory interest, you wouldn't be able to trigger a default provision in an agreement when the money's being deposited to avoid that default. So although there's no specific authority, I think it's a logical extension of that rule.
Would there be a difference in that analysis if the party interpleading the funds in the court was in default of the contractual provisions at the time the funds were deposited in an interpleader action?
I think there could be scenarios where if a default had already occurred, and you tried to take advantage of an interpleader after the fact, either it would be a situation where the court would have to calculate some default interest through the date of deposit, depending on the circumstances. But maybe there are instances where the court could determine that the rule was being used to, you know, avoid something like that. Although if you're in default, it doesn't seem like the rule would really be abused in that fashion, because it does require you to deposit all the funds with the court. So really, it's only used in circumstances where you have a good faith reason to not actually make the payment, because you're still required to turn over the funds. So it's not just a refusal to pay. So there could be a distinction, but I certainly don't see it as having wide, you know, birthing consequences to it. And I still think that the rule is logical in its purpose to not permit those types of claims to come in. Newflower deposited these funds strictly to avoid additional liability, which would include claims of default interest and attorney's fees and damages and everything else. So that protection has to be facilitated there. Otherwise, the purpose of the rule would really be thwarted. So going back to a few points that Mr. Weinberg made, I think part of the problem here in terms of the second issue, which he raised, which is this allocation issue, the appellant really, in terms of all the issues raised on appeal, wants the various agreements to be read independently when it suits them, but together when it suits them more. You have to construe all of these agreements and the promissory notes together. So the allocation issue that was arisen, which is one of the reasons that the funds were deposited, an issue came up, a question was asked about whether the trial court really read out the allocation provision from the agreements. And I would suggest that's absolutely not what happened. The trial court recognized the allocation provision and merely suggested that if you're going to allocate, it comes along with all of the other terms and conditions of payment. So there are two payments. There's the $4.85 million payment, which is undisputed, that was made on the date that it was due. Cook then decided to take $2 million of that and allocate it to paying off the second payment that was due. The second payment is the one that had the conditions attached to it for the deposit into the account.
Interrupt you there.
Sure.
Sorry to interrupt you, but this question has been on my mind since reading the briefs. Why did Cook do that? What was the motivation for, and is there anything in the record indicating the motivation for allocating that $2 million to the FLP note rather than just the payment of the $4.85 million obligation?
I believe that it is in the record, although it may just be argument of counsel contained in the record. But I think one of the stated reasons given for that was that there was some security attached to the first payment, the $4.85 million note, that if they had allocated that entire payment to pay that off, then that security that was attached to that would also be released. They would lose their security interest in whatever the property there was some security provision there that did not exist on the second payment. We don't necessarily suggest that she couldn't do the allocation. The issue is, if you're going to allocate, because we didn't object to the security remaining, you have to take the other terms and conditions with that. And the specific condition to that second payment, if you're going to pay that off, you can't pay it off and say, Well, I'm going to pay this off, but the condition of depositing this payment into the third-party account doesn't exist until you actually make the second payment, even though it's going to be allocated over here.
Ms. Bruch, one of the other conditions that the trial court mentioned was that the FLP note hadn't been broken up.
Correct.
And Mr. Weinberg has argued that, well, he said one of the unanswered questions is that whose duty was it to break up that note, and he says in his briefs that it was New Flowers. Well, what is your response to that?
New Flower had absolutely no control over the FLP. New Flower was not a party to the FLP. It was a family limited partnership is what FLP stands for. New Flower wasn't a member. It was set up between the other parties to the case.
Well,
New Flower's sole obligation related to that was when the parties did their winding up and canceled the main FLP note, we were obligated to issue five separate notes that total the same amount, but just to the various partners who were members of the limited partnership. It was just part of the winding up process. Those notes were delivered unsigned, obviously, because we're not going to deliver live notes to five people when we still have the full note over here. Copies of them were delivered several times, and we said we're prepared to do this. But we absolutely, New Flower was not going to sign five new notes totaling almost $5 million when the FLP didn't cancel the original note. It was still live. It was still being held by the FLP. It's not unreasonable that New Flower would say, you have to do it as an exchange. And we had no control over that. In fact, Ms. Cook was the managing partner of the FLP. She could have facilitated that. And in fact, she also represented the FLP in the litigation at the beginning and could have facilitated it through the court or filed a disclaimer to the funds, none of which happened. So I think New Flower had absolutely no obligation with respect to the breakup of the FLP and could not make that payment without the note being canceled.
Before your time runs out, I want to ask you this question. Cook says that the trial court erred in granting summary judgment in your favor on her counterclaim for good faith, a breach of the duty of good faith. The way I understand it, they are arguing that because good faith is a factual determination, that by itself creates a material factual issue to be determined at trial rather than being the subject of a summary judgment. Can you respond to that?
I can. I think there are two reasons why it's not a factual issue. First of all, it was undisputed in the record that the district court had in front of it that New Flower, this is all based on objection to the third-party account. I believe that's the sole allegation related to that good faith and fair dealing claim. New Flower did not object to the account. We took no position on the account. And the second issue was the court actually accepted the fact as true that New Flower objected to the account as part of the summary judgment. So she actually construed that against us as the movement and said, but it didn't matter because Cook and Gilliland, the other two parties who had to agree, it was undisputed, both of them could not agree. So it made no difference what our position was. The funds could not be deposited, and therefore summary judgment was appropriate. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Ms. Bruch. We appreciate your argument.
Thank you, Your Honors. I just touch on a couple of the points raised in the brief time I have. Number one, on the interest being paid through maturity, as Ms. Bruch had indicated, I think she misspoke. She said interest had been paid through January 2nd, 2009. In point of fact, the maturity was January, the payment was due January 2nd, 2008. The money sat in the court for some 16 months at 1% or less interest when the benefit of the bargain to Ms. Cook was the ability to control the investment of that money, generate a return on that money. So it wasn't just a couple of months. We're talking hundreds of thousands of dollars. And whatever was owed under that promissory note or the settlement agreement can be remanded for the trial court to determine on how much interest, whether default interest applies, the attorney fees, all of the stuff that's owed on the note needs to be calculated. As the settlement agreement stated, the promissory note remains in effect. The second issue that was raised, and I think Ms. Bruch adequately answered it, was the motivation for making the allocation. There is evidence in the record, Your Honors, about the shenanigans that were being pulled by New Flower and its controlling shareholder, which was my client's ex-husband, in not cooperating in the establishment of that account and objecting to escrow language that was verbatim identical to the language in the settlement agreement. When Ms. Cook saw that there were going to be games played with depositing this extra $1.9 million, she knew she needed to make the allocation because the amounts that were remained owed under the $4.85 million note were secured. The amounts owed under the FLP note were not. Final point, this is not a competing claim to funds. There was only one person that had a claim to this money. The issue raised by the interpleader was where to deposit the money. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Weinberg. Thanks again, Ms. Bruch. We appreciate both of your arguments this morning in this case. The case will stand submitted, and a written opinion will issue in due course. That concludes the oral arguments this morning for Division 1. The court will be in recess, and the bailiff may so announce.
All rise.